How are you all feeling today? I think we should continue where we left off, not last week, the week before. I feel today's a good day for that. I don't know how I feel this way, but from time to time I feel these things. I feel weird things. Like today's a good day. Is today a good day? Today's a good day, isn't it? Yes, it's a nice day. It's a wonderful day. The sun is out. What's a good day like? Is it a day when the sun is out? What is your definition of a good day? How do you know the day is good? When the sun is out? When things are all going to plan? When you get your morning tea just on time and it's nice and warm? Do you have good days and bad days? Yeah? Do you? Still? Are you okay with that? I'm sure you're okay with the good days. What about the bad days? Who's responsible for that? The bad days. No, don't say yourself. It's easier when we think it's somebody else, isn't it? Who's responsible for our bad days? Others. There's a nice word when we don't feel like pointing our finger at ourselves. It's a wonderful word. Others. Others. Bad days, good days, bad days, mediocre days, so-so days. Do you have them? Which ones do you have more of? Good days, bad days, or so-so days? What if it was possible to make every day a good day? Wishful thinking, huh? How can every day be a good day, Swami Nasa? Life is such, you know, it has its ups and downs. Yeah? There are the good days and the bad days. Life is like a river. Is it possible to have a good day every day? Is it? I'm asking you, is it? Have you tried to have a good day every day? Have you been successful so far? Where it doesn't seem like the day is going to be good, what have you come to think as the reasons for that? Where have you looked for the answers? Where have you looked for the culprit? When things don't go right, when it's a bad day, at the end of the day, if you're feeling cheerful, if you're feeling happy, if you're feeling elated, that's a good day. Whereas at the end of the day, if you're feeling down, if you're not feeling too good, if you're not feeling like you are able to accomplish many of the tasks that you'd set for yourself, or perhaps, you know, someone rang you up and they said something hurtful, those things happen, don't they? Sometimes when you act with the best of intentions, but others don't see it that way. Has that not happened to you? And you fail to see why they don't see it from your perspective? Don't you feel like sometimes you have been the victim? When you've clearly acted with good intention? No? When you know, hand on heart, that you did the right thing, and nothing you said was meant to hurt, to annoy, but someone took it the wrong way. Something you said just rubbed them up the wrong way. Bad days. Are you okay with having the rest of the world decide and determine whether your day is good or bad? Are you okay with that? Honestly, are you? You know, why do we learn things? Why do we learn, for instance, how to make money? Why do we learn? Why do we learn? Why do we get ourselves a good education? So we don't have to depend on others. Starting with our parents, for instance, yeah? Now, myself included, I think most of us will agree that when we were younger, we wanted to grow up, earn for ourselves, make a living for ourselves, and become self-sufficient so that we wouldn't have to be a burden on others, on society, on our parents, right, and siblings and so on. So, you know, we have this innate desire to become independent. And then when it's time, we leave home, we say goodbye to our folks, and then we go and settle down, start our own family, find our own little place, because we don't feel like we want to be a burden to others. Now, even if you, when you get here, right, now say, for instance, you want to go somewhere, and someone offers you a ride. Before you accept, sometimes you do take a moment, don't you, to consider whether accepting that might be a burden to them, don't you? Yeah. Because we are courteous and we always do that. If you go somewhere, perhaps, you know, you'll take your own umbrella. Maybe you'll take your own water bottle. Because you don't want to be a burden to others. And in the same way, you want to feel you're independent. In other words, when you have needs, when you have a problem, you have a solution to hand that you can accomplish by yourselves and you don't have to rely on others. This sense of independence, we've always wanted as a race. We've always wanted to be independent. Every nation that I know of, at some point, you know, either successful or not, they have always fought for their independence. Many decades ago, we won our independence. 1948, yes. We won our independence. We won our independence from the British. So now we are free to do as we wish. Do you do as you wish? Do you? There was the Dutch. And we won our independence. And we were free to do as we wish. Were we? Are we? Are you free to do as you wish? I don't think so. I think despite all the battles we have fought, all the victories we won, for the namesake of independence, we are still very much slaves. And here's the one thing we are all slaves to. Happiness. Let me give you a simple task. You can do it right now. Mentally, and I'll give you a couple of minutes to do that. Mentally, make a note, make a mental note of three things that would make you really happy. Three things that would make you really happy. All right, off you go. I'll give you a couple of minutes. Make a mental note. If you are with someone you know, you can share it with them. Perhaps you've come here with some friends or maybe someone in the family. You can feel free to share it with them. If not, make a mental note of three things, just three things that would really make you happy. Right? I'll be silent until you do that. One more minute to go. Three things that would really make you happy. I have my magic wand here. And make dreams come true. Got it? Three things that would really make you happy? Right. These three things, let's take number one on that list. Now, clearly, I don't know exactly what you've got in mind, but I would like to share a few of my own thoughts, and I'd like you to think whether what I share with you now is common across all three things. Now, I know few and far between, there may be one or two for whom this might not be true, but I think that's because you know what I'm getting at. You're trying to outsmart me. Stop it. See, these three things. Let's take number one. Is there anyone in this thing that makes you happy besides you? Have a think. Is there anything or anyone besides you? Meaning, I'll take just one example, right? Something that comes to the top of my mind. I would like to have the rest of the year off. I would like to have the rest of the year off. That is certainly wishful thinking, but you know, I didn't set any restrictions on what you could think, but let's say that is what you thought, or something along those lines. Isn't there someone or something besides you in that equation to make it happen? You have to have someone else's involvement or something else's involvement. Let's take another one. I would like my other half to give me a surprise birthday party. Perhaps you've got your birthday coming up soon enough. Maybe it's your friends, maybe your other half. You like your family to give you a surprise birthday party. Perhaps that is what was on your mind. Maybe you had something like, I would like that promotion that I've been looking for the last few years. Last couple of years I've been waiting for that promotion. I'd like that to happen. And if that did, I'd be very happy. Perhaps some of you might have had something along the lines of, I've got the games coming up later on. Maybe you're into sports. Perhaps you're a fan. And I'd really like for my team, whether it is that you play in that team or the team that you are in favor of, I would like them to win at the next tournament and I'd be very happy. Or maybe you're in the middle of a business deal and you'd like that deal to go through and for there to be a windfall in your favor. Perhaps that would make you very happy. See, in any of these examples, each and every one of these examples I'm sharing with you, so I don't know what examples you had in mind, but in the ones that I'm sharing with you, there's another person, there's another party involved. Someone else or something else gets to call the shots. Even if it was something as simple as, I wish Ramin Mansur would finish on time today. See? There's still someone else involved. I wish Ramin Mansur would say, next week off. We don't have classes next week. Take some time out. See, still, there's still someone involved. What if perhaps you're thinking, it's too cold in here. I wish someone would turn down the aircon. There's still the aircon. Someone or something always features. They have a prominent place in the things that make us happy. Now, if you came up with three things that did not feature someone else or something else, then you're very special. You're very special indeed. Typically, whatever you come up with will always have someone else or something else. I wish my children would treat me well. I wish my children would be with me for as long as I'd like them to. I wish my children would call me once in a while. I hope my children are safe. And if they're safe, and if they're well, nothing would make me happier. There's always something or someone else in this equation. So for this equation to balance in your favor, you are reliant on someone or something else, an external party. What does that make you? in one word. It starts with V and ends with E. It makes you vulnerable. Makes you what? Makes you vulnerable. Makes you susceptible. It makes you vulnerable to the external environment. So who is a Buddhist by definition? How do they stand out? In some faiths, you need God to keep you happy. So praise to God. If God is happy, He shall keep me happy. So I make it my life's purpose to please Him. Again, there's someone else or something else. You're vulnerable. What makes a Buddhist stand out of this? When you become solely independent, when your happiness is not reliant, not dependent on anyone else or anything else, not even Almighty God. How about that? Would you like that? If not, let's talk about something else. You know, of course I have to ask you, what do you want? This is a la carte. Right? You have to order. Would you like that, I ask you? Would you like for yourselves to be independently happy? Would you? Or would you like for someone else to make you happy? Do you require your spouse, your fiancé, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your friend? Do you want them to always have your best interests at heart? Do you always want them to consider you? Do they have to consider you? But what happens when they are on the horns of a dilemma? When they have their own desires and wants that they have to satisfy versus yours, what happens then? When you become a pawn in the game, when you are the one who has to be sacrificed for their gain, then what happens? Have you never been on the receiving end of that? Sometimes it can come from your best friend. Sometimes it can come from the people you trust the most. From the people you expect to never have anything other than your best interests at heart. Sometimes it can come from them. Because when push comes to shove, you don't know what's coming next. By definition, I believe a Buddhist is someone who hangs his hat of happiness on no hook that is external. His hat of happiness is his and his alone, and he doesn't go hanging it on others' hooks. The purpose of these talks, ladies and gentlemen, is so that you can become independent. And this is not just on someone or somebody else or something else. This something else includes your physical health. Soon enough, this is one of the things that's going to torment you. Because age catches up, and although in your youthful years you were able to wait them off, but as age catches up, it's going to get tougher and tougher and tougher. Things that were so simple and easy to do will become almost impossible. Just turning around on the bed, on your own bed, is going to be a mission. Getting out of bed is going to be twice the mission. Getting around is going to be so incredibly difficult. Just take a moment to think about your beloved mother, for instance, right now. Perhaps she's youthful enough to be with you today, here, but maybe she's not. Just take a quick walk down memory lane. Try and remember what happened with your mother, what happened with your father, perhaps your grandmother. And how they had to spend the last years of their lives bedridden, unable to fend for themselves. See, in those years, do you not remember how frustrated they were? Do you not remember that? Do you not remember how rejected they felt? How much of a burden they felt they were perhaps on themselves and even on you? Do you not remember? Maybe to this day, they suffer. But their physical pains and aches have gotten the better of them. The purpose of these talks is to prepare you for that inevitable day whereby even when your health fails you, your physical health fails you, you can still be a happy man. You can still be a happy person. A lot of the time I receive people at our monastery, some who are quite elderly. And although some might come and say, I have problems with my family, my children, they won't listen to me, my friends or my family, they've abandoned me and so on. Others will come up to me and say, Swaminarayana, you know, I'm really weak now, I'm really frail and my physical health is just really weighing me down. I can't be cheerful as I used to be because of these aches and pains and I can't get around, I can't get about. I have to rely on my family for everything and I feel like I'm being a burden to them. I ask myself, what is the purpose of me being around any longer? Is it so terrible if I off with my own life? People sometimes come and ask me. Oh, I do. People do come and ask. Is it a sin in Buddhist teaching to do away with your own life? In some countries, you know, it has become an accepted practice, euthanasia. Sometimes children, they come and ask, Swami Nahansa, my mother, she's in hospital. She's doing very poorly. She's still conscious, but she's under heavy anesthetics. She's always under morphine or some painkillers. And do we continue to keep her that way? Or is it right that we switch her off? What do we do? They come and ask me for advice. Because the doctors keep sending them the bills. Every month, there's a bill you have to pay. That is a price tag for keeping your mother alive. But she's now like a vegetable. She doesn't do much. She barely responds to us when we go to see her. Is it meaningful any longer to keep her going, plugged to a machine? Sometimes people ask me this question. If you ever come across this conundrum, I'll give you the short answer today. I'll give you the long answer, the fully explained, in-depth answer another day, because today is not the day for that. If you ever find yourself in this situation where you are asked the question, do we keep your mother going or shall we switch her off? Never say yes. Do yourselves a favor and never say yes. Where your mother and father are concerned, where your biological mother and father are concerned, it's a whole new ball game. The rules are not the same as it applies to everything else. Because to you, your mother and father are extraordinary. So, if you are ever in that situation where you are asked to determine on or off, I hope you never find yourself in that unfortunate situation. I wish and pray that you never find yourself in that unfortunate situation. But if you ever do find yourselves to save you the hassle of coming and asking me when, I shall answer now. Try and get yourself out of that question and see if someone else can make that decision on your behalf. But don't you ever, no matter what you do, don't you ever answer yes, switch her off to that question. From there on, I can't save you. I can't save you, not today, not tomorrow, perhaps not for a million eons. I can't save you. No one can, not even the Buddha can. People don't realize these things. It's a heinous sin, an anantariya papa karma. Yes, your intentions may be that she's in pain, she's hurting, and I want to save her. I want to save her from pain. Perhaps that is your intention. But whatever your intentions are, you will intend to switch her off. That is also your intention. Never find yourself in that situation. I hope and pray that you never would. But if you do, get out of it. Try and delegate that to somebody else, if at all possible. Maybe a cousin, maybe a brother of the mother, somebody else. Just don't be the one who has to make that choice. That's the short answer. One day I'll give you the long answer. Not today. But one day age is going to catch up with all of us. Now, personally, my father is going through a tough time. Old age is catching up. Now, he was a scientist, which is how I got my scientific way of thinking about things. So I have him to thank for that. But that is what he was, a scientist. He was not a Buddhist. I'm trying to make him a Buddhist. I'm trying to help him to understand Buddhist philosophy. He's a very good man, a wonderful man. But today, with an ailing body, weak, he struggles. He struggles to maintain his cool. He struggles to maintain his peace of mind. So if my father is like that, then I can only assume that for most of you, your parents will have to walk the same mile. And then we will follow. And then our children will follow. But we shouldn't be leaving it when it's too late. Too little, too late. So that is why we have to address these concerns now. If I can help you become independent of your physical form, wouldn't that be nice? Do you think it's impossible? Don't you think it's possible to free yourself from your physical form? You'll still be in there, don't you worry. And when you feel like walking around, your body will walk with you. Don't you worry about that. So you will be still in this physical body, but you will not identify with it. So then, when you hurt, your mind will simply do what it's supposed to do. What are the five things the mind is supposed to do? Revision. Receive. Register. Absolutely. Recognize. Respond. And perceive. These are the five things the mind is meant to do and nothing more. But an untamed mind cannot stop at this five. It does more than this. It identifies itself with the things that it receives. And these things that we receive, that it receives, we talked about. The five senses. I'm just quickly going to jot it back on the board so we can continue our conversation. The purpose of this is to help you free yourselves from this physical form. The purpose of this is to help yourselves become independent of the things that work and operate around you. If what sees or what meets the eye cannot bother you, cannot hurt you, you're free. from the eye. If what comes in through your ears cannot hurt you, then you are free from your ear. If what touches your tongue cannot hurt you, then you are free from your tongue. If what touches your nose cannot hurt you, cannot bother you, then you are free from your nose. And if what touches your physical body cannot hurt you, then you are free from your physical form. And once you are free from sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, you are free. But right now, you are a slave to them. That is why you have to protect and safeguard your eyes, because you want to see, don't you? Why is a dark room a punishment? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Why is a dark room a punishment? Because in a dark room, you can't see. Why is deafness a punishment? Because you want to hear, but you can't hear. Are you willing to volunteer to lose your sense of taste? Who here in the room is willing to volunteer? Your sense of taste, nothing more. You can still see, you can still hear, you can walk about, touch things, smell things, but you can't taste things. Are you happy to volunteer for that? No, of course not. It's just taste. I mean, come on. You can still live. You know, without a tongue, couldn't you live? I mean, yes, the tongue will help you talk, eat, digest your food, whatever. But you just want to be able to taste things. Are you okay? What if I gave you $1 billion? Are you now willing to sacrifice your sense of taste? $1 billion. Are you? For the rest of your life, you can't get it back. And then this for another billion, you have to give up your sense of smell for $1 billion. You know, the best way to answer this question is this. If you lost your sense of taste, how much would you be willing to pay to have it reinstated? I ask you the question. If you lost your sense of taste right now, and they say there was some medical procedure that could be done, right? It's barely invasive, but it costs a lot. How much are you personally willing to pay to regain your sense of taste? 500 rupees? I'll keep going. You tell me, no, that's it, Saminas, and not beyond that. 1,000? 10,000? 25,000? For your sense of taste. This is like an auction. How much are you willing to pay for your sense of taste? Another way you could think of this is, someone told me these days, these motor cars, they come with things like heated seats, but it's by subscription. You have to pay for it. How much are you willing to pay for that optional feature? Let's imagine you were born with the physical sense organ, but you had to pay to actually start sensing taste. Okay? So you have a tongue. You're born with a tongue. You're born with a nose, but you have to pay to have it switched on, to have it enabled. Maybe you have to go to the Devale for that. With a basket of fruits, and it depends on how much you put on the basket, right? If the gods are pleased, they'll switch it on. They'll turn on the circuit. And then, out of nowhere, you can now start smelling and tasting things. I'm asking you, how much are you willing to pay for that? This is a good story for a fiction, science fiction story, isn't it? Yeah. If ever you decide to make that story, please make sure that I get my credit. Copyrights reserved, okay? It's my idea. So, I'm seriously, imagine this situation. You are born, you have a tongue, you have a nose, right? And there are others around you, they can taste things and they can smell things. So they walk up to things and go, they pick it up and go, "Wow, that smells really nice. Would you like to?" And then you can't respond to it because you have no sense of smell. Or they chew on this and go, "That tastes really nice. Would you like some?" Or even if they said, "That tastes so bitter. I don't like that." What would you still feel? It tastes bitter, apparently. Do you still not want to know what that tastes like? What does bitter taste like? Even if they said, "Yeah, I have proof of this." Now, please don't feel embarrassed, but I have to make use of real life examples to help the penny drop. Okay? I've warned you. You know, sometimes when people say, "What's that smell?" What do? What do you do? Show me. No? "What's that foul smell? What's that stench? What is that? What do you normally do? Let me see." And you fill your lungs up with it, don't you? Even when it has been, when you have been informed that it's a foul smell, that it's a stench, it's putrid, you still want to know what it smells like. Or when someone says, "Look at that, how ugly." What do you say? "Show me." No? Of course. That is because above all, we are cursed with curiosity. We want to know what the world is like. See, I want you to make use of all these things to understand yourselves. Right? Understanding geography and biology is one, but understanding yourself is a whole new thing. Something else. Why do you do that? Have you never wondered why you do that? If someone passes wind, forgive me for using the word, if someone farts, right? And then they say, "That smells terrible." What do you normally do? Yeah, you fart, or you don't like to admit it. It's embarrassing to admit, but this is just human nature. This is just human nature. Deep down inside, we are cursed with curiosity. And we need to understand why. Because you're always seeking input from the outside world. Because you expect something to come from the outside. What is that something? What is that something? The something that you rely and depend on others and other things. What is that? Happiness. Why do they always end an episode on a high? Or perhaps they end an episode on a, what do you call it? There's a word for it. Cliffhanger, thank you. Why do they always end an episode on a cliffhanger? Curiosity. It makes you watch the next episode. Why? Curiosity. Why are you curious? Do you know why you're curious? Is that a part of your body that is curious? No. It's your mind that is curious, clearly. Sometimes you are so curious that your body has to pay the price. Someone says, "That's hot." What do you do? Show me. Let me see. Someone says, "That's pricky. Ouch. That's sharp." What do you do? Let me see. Sometimes, you know, your body has to pay the price. Why? What about when people go and do like adventure sports like bungee jumping or jumping off an aircraft or something like that? Why do they do that? Don't they know that they're taking a risk? A huge risk? Do you think if it were down to the body, do you think the body would agree to it? Let's take a vote. Okay, I want your left hand to go up on behalf of your mind, and I want your right arm to go up on behalf of your body. Okay? Bungee jumping, shall we? Absolutely better. Only the left arm went up. What about the right? What would your body say if you asked bungee jumping? Are you nuts? Wouldn't that be the body's response? Adventure sports? Mountain climbing? Abseiling? One slip? One wrong step, and what would happen? That's it. Some people don't even use safety harnesses. I know this because I've done it. Not without the safety harness. I've always used safety harnesses, but I've been there, done that. Like I said, I haven't fallen out of the sky, so I know where people come from. And I understand people's desires and wants. I know today that if my body were asked back then, shall we go mountain climbing, rock climbing? The body would certainly have said, are you crazy? But the mind wanted it. Because the mind was curious. The mind wanted to know what that feels like. The mind wanted to experience it. Why is your mind like that? See, when two people have a conversation, and you know, is it not considered rude to for two people to have a hush-hush conversation when you're also in the room? Is it not considered rude? It is, right? When if you're also in the room and two people are having a conversation, let's say you just walk into the room and they stop talking. How do you feel in this moment? You are talking with, oh, you walk into a room and two people there, they were having a conversation before you walked into the room, and the moment they saw you, they just stopped talking. How would you feel? Normally, what is your response to that? Don't you have a question to ask them? What do you normally do? What do you normally say? What were you talking about? Why? Why do you need to know? Why are you curious? How do you define curiosity? Remember when you used to be kids and you used to play? Like someone would pick something, maybe say pick something out of a book or pick something off the ground, and then they would hide it behind their backs and they would say, I'm not going to show it to you. It's for me to know and for you to find out, they'd say. And then sometimes you'd fight them and even beat them down until they showed you what they had in their hands. Perhaps it was just a pebble. If you remember your younger years and how you used to play with your siblings and so on, right? These were some of the things you used to play. You know, right from the tender years till today, you're still curious. Why are you so curious? What is this curiosity? They say curiosity kills the cat. Why are you so curious? Why is it rude for someone to be on the phone when you're in the room and you don't know the other person that they're talking to? It's considered rude. Impolite. Why is that? Let's just say someone's on the phone, right? And you're maybe on the bus or the train, right? And this is the conversation they're having with the person on the other end. Hello? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. No. Really? They did what? Don't tell that to anybody. Yeah, okay. Please, don't tell that to anybody, all right? I can't talk to you right now. There are people watching. All right, okay, goodbye, bye, bye. Talk to you soon. That was a conversation. Complete stranger. unrelated to you. This is the first time you've seen them. Right? From that moment till the moment you get off the bus, what are you going to be thinking about? Well, I wonder who they were talking to. I wonder what they were talking about. Why? I ask you, why? Why are you so curious? When curiosity strikes, what do you do about it? How do you deal with it? You don't know. All of this boils down to one thing, ladies and gentlemen. You expect the world, the external world, to make you happy. How is it that curiosity helps you to become happy? That's a good question. And you're welcome, because I asked it. How does curiosity help you to become happy? As of late, there are these new channels on YouTube. Someone showed me the other day, where they do these like really absurd things. I mean, it seems absurd to someone like myself, but these videos, they amass many hundreds, thousands, if not millions of viewers. Here's what they do. They'll take a bunch of balloons, let's just say, colored balloons. They fill them up with water. It's nothing more than water, maybe colored water. They'll put it under a truck or a car or some sort, and then they'll drive over it. And the balloon bursts. End of story. That is the video. So many viewers. Or they put something under a hydraulic hammer. It could be all sorts of things. Sometimes there are iPads. Sometimes there are glasses. Maybe sometimes there are just ornaments that you can find in an average home. They put it under a hydraulic hammer, and then they show you what happens to it as the hammer crushes it. That's the video. How much have you gained for your life by watching it? How much more are you wiser? You're none the wiser, but that's the video. When a talk like this might get 2 or 3 viewers, a talk like that, not a talk, in fact, a video like that can amass, they go viral. Those channels get enough and more subscribers. Do you know why that is? You've got to wonder why. Why is it that, how come they become so popular when they have nothing to offer? Seemingly, they have nothing to offer. Why are they so popular? Here's the reason. Curiosity. You want to know what happens. You want to find out what's going to happen. So why are we so curious? We are so curious because we expect the outside world to make us happy. How does curiosity help you do that? That is a question we need to find an answer to. Let's get onto the board and continue where we stopped a couple of weeks ago so we can continue that conversation and I can help you figure the answers to these problems. What we're trying to figure, because we discussed the other day about the perception process, how an object leads all the way to perception. But now we begin to realize that that is not it. There should be more to it. Why are we curious? Why do we suffer? Why do we feel hurt? Why do we feel pain? Not physical pain. Why do we feel mental pains? Why do we feel anguish and anger? Because these are the answers you've all come for, right? I mean, seriously, you've not come here to learn about how the mind works just for the sake of it. We've all come here to learn why the mind experiences these tumultuous, these tormentous feelings, experiences, so that I can free myself from them. That's why you have come. How do I deal with disappointments? How do I deal with frustrations? How do I deal with anger, grievance, sorrow, and fear? Right? So that's what we need to get to. The body and the mind. Right? Quick reminder of what we've discussed so far. The body has attached to it 5 sense organs.
We have the eyes, ears, nose, tongue,
and the remainder of the body. Wherever you can sense physical sensations, including on the inside. Like for instance, when you get appendicitis, right? That is physical contact that you experience.
So that's the rest of the body.
All of these 5 sense organs, they bring stimuli. Right? And simple science teaches us how that happens. We don't need the Buddha's teaching to understand all this stuff. We know that we all have a nervous system, and these nerves, they conduct electrical impulses through the axons, right? And they carry those signals all the way up to the brain.
So these 5 sense organs, they feed the brain.
And very briefly, I explained to you how the brain is responsible for translating these signals to an input that the mind can interpret. Okay? So from here on, I'm going to leave out this part, because that is not the part that we need to focus on from here on. What we are more interested in is, once the signals come to the mind, once the mind receives this input, what happens then? Because that's where the fun and games begin. Let's take the eye and the sight object. So I've bypassed all of the detail in between, and now I'm talking about the mind. The mind itself, we can consider to be an organ. And it's not a physical organ, or let's call it a faculty. The mind is a faculty. Like the eye is a faculty, the nose is a faculty, the mind itself is a faculty. In the mind, chittas are born. This is how you perceive. So when you have a thought, those thoughts are chittas accumulated. So now when we have a thought about something, it's never an individual thought, because we think in groups of chittas. Because an individual chitta is not capable of doing all that you're able to do right now. So for instance, when I show you this pen, and you perceive that this is a pen, that is not an individual chitta that has perceived this is a pen. It's a collection of it. So there are multiple chittas. So there's one after the other. Right? It's like a stream of chittas. And each chitta is able to refer back to previous chittas, refer back to memory, as we talked about, and perceive objects. Because it is not an individual chitta that can see a pen. It's a collection. But let's focus on one chitta for the time being. Because if you understand one, you understand a lot. Let's focus on one chitta for the time being. The job of this chitta is 5 things. We talked about this. One is to receive, to register, to recognize, respond, and to perceive. Now quickly, to remind you what each of these things are, to receive is simply that, receive. To accept. Like I use the analogy of a delivery driver delivering a parcel to your home. Right? When you're at home, you hear a knock on the door, right? And then you walk up to the door, open the door, and you receive whatever they have brought for you. Once they open the door and they hand it over to you, now you have received it and you have also registered it. So as a token of that, you might sign it to confirm receipt. Yeah? So that is registering. This is an analogous to the what we're talking about. Next, we have to recognize it. So once you've registered it, you open the parcel up and you try to figure out what it is you have received. Where is it from? Who sent it? What is the said item? What does it contain? Once you've figured what it is, now you need to figure out what you do with it. Do you keep it? Do you put it in a drawer? Do you throw it in the bin? Do you return it, for instance? Yeah, do you pass it on to somebody else? Do you pick it up and give it a shake?
So we have now received the parcel, we've registered the parcel, we've recognized the parcel, we've responded to the parcel. And now, once we've figured all that out, we can come to a conclusion of the whole event. Right? The whole thing makes sense to us now. So when we talk about making sense of the world, this is what happens. This is how you make sense of the world, quite simply. When I show you this pen, you don't merely see a physical object. You identify that this is a pen at the same time as seeing it. You know that this is something you can use to write at the same time as knowing that this is a pen. See, all the data comes to you in a moment, doesn't it? In almost what seems like an instant, everything comes to you. This is simplified. Whereas for all this to happen, you need several of these cycles to run. But for the sake of our conversation, I'm really simplifying this. Let's not get bogged down with more detail than we need. Because what really happens is, once one of these happens with the eye consciousness, then you have this come into contact with the mind, and several more cycles are triggered, which is ultimately how you perceive all this. But we don't need to get into all that detail for now. For the time being, we take a very simple perspective on this. So this is a chitta, starts here and ends here. And once again, this is not what a chitta looks like, because what does chitta look like? What does it look like? It doesn't look like anything at all, because it is not something to look like something. It's an energy. What does electrical energy look like? It doesn't have a form, right? But you know that it is capable of doing something. Energy is the ability to do some work. And the chitta is also the ability to do some work. What is that work? The Buddha's words are Aramana Vijanana Lakkhanam Chittam. That is in the Pali. Pali again. How he defines the chitta is, the chitta is the ability, that is how he says, the ability or the characteristic. Lakkhana is characteristic. The characteristic of identifying and recognizing an object. That is what a chitta is. Why are we interested about this? Well, that's what's going on within all of you right now. How are you perceiving the world? Because this is going on inside of you right now. Just like your breakfast is being digested within yourselves right now, this is happening inside your bodies right now. But it's not a bodily function, it's a mental function. Okay? So these five things are going on. Now, I made that noise. The moment I made that noise, you know that that was a click. I flicked my fingers. How long did it take you to do that? To perceive that? Hardly any time at all, right? Now, talk me through how that happened. Was it the ear? Of course not. No, it wasn't the eye. No, it's with the ear. So you have the ear. Sound. Electrical impulse. Down to the brain. And from the brain, what we call an auditory image. A sabdarupa. Okay? An auditory image. So this would be a visual image. This would be an auditory image. These images, they don't take room. They don't take space. So you can't ask me how many megabytes or kilobytes is that. It's not like that. And is it a JPEG or a PNG? You can't ask me about that. This format is purely mental. This is the translation that happens between the mind and the brain. Okay? So you have the auditory image that is dropped onto the mind. That's dropped onto the mind, and the moment that happens, ladies and gentlemen, one of these is born. What is one of these? A chitta. This is a chitta. So if the mind is the faculty, the chitta is the instrument that perceives. If you
be familiar with the first stanza in the Dhammapada. If you've ever done any reading of the Dhammapada, the first stanza in the Dhammapada, Mano Pubbangama Dhamma, Mano Setta Mano Maya, Manasache Paduttena Bhasativa Karotiva, and it goes on. But Mano Pubbangama Dhamma, Mano Pubbangama Dhamma, Mana is the mind. Dhamma, now here I'm going to be sharing with you some definitions which you may not have come across before. And like I asked you the other day, you may already come with preconceptions of some of the concepts of Buddhist philosophy, but I asked you to do me a favor. What was that? Leave it out there. And we've asked the janitor not to sweep it. So, when you go back home, you can collect it all again. But for the time being, you're here, I need you to just leave it out there so that you can be receptive to what I have to share with you. That is not me asking you to take all this as gospel. I would never do that. I'm a scientist initially and then a monk, right? So, the scientific method should involve analysis. But first, you have to be attentive. Receive what is given and then you can do your own analysis. What is Dhamma? Now, what are the Dhammas that you know? Buddha Dhamma. That is Dhamma. What other Dhamma do you know? What about Catholic Dhamma? No? If I said it in Sinhalese, you go, yes, Catholic Dharma. Ah, yes. What about Islam? Is that not Dhamma? Dhamma is a teaching. But that is the Dhamma that you know. There is something more than that to Dhamma. Dhamma is what the mind bears. That is the definition I want you to take for now. What the mind bears. Bears meaning carries, holds. So whatever the mind can bear, that is the Dhamma. Okay? So, when I made this sound earlier, and I flicked my fingers, that was an auditory impression or an auditory image that was dropped on the mind, and now it's the mind's turn to interpret this, because that is what the mind does. Aramana, vijana, lakkhana, chitta. The mind's characteristic is the receiving and the recognition and the perception of objects. This object is now the Dhamma because it is what the mind is going to bear. And if I threw a ball at you, what would you do? You'd catch it, wouldn't you? And then you'd decide what to do with it. Perhaps you might pass it back to me. Maybe you might keep it to a side. Maybe you might use it for something else. Right? You decide what to do with it. But first of all, you're going to catch it. Shall we try it? In the same way, when the brain drops, have you seen brain drops? Like raindrops. When the brain drops an auditory image on the mind catches it. And once the mind catches it, that is the mind's Dhamma. So now this definition of Dhamma goes beyond the Dhamma that you've understood so far. You've been thinking the Buddha Dhamma, right? You've been thinking Zen Dhamma, right? Whatever Dhamma. Here I'm talking about the Dhamma, by definition, is the what the mind bears. Now, what does the mind bear now? The auditory image. Excuse me. If it was something that came through the eye, it would be the visual image. If it was something that came through the nose, what do you call that? Olfactory image? Okay. And if it's something that came through the tongue, taste image? Keep it simple. Taste image. If it came through the body, physical sensations, then we can call it the touch image or the tactile image. Why do I call these images? Because it leaves an impression on the mind. It's an image. Okay? So now that's what's going in the mind. And as soon as this sound drops on the mind, now the mind's job is to interpret it. Aramana, vijana, lakana. Aramana is the object. Aramuna is the object. Vijanana is perception. So in Pali, vijanana is perception. So that is a perception that has to happen right at the end. But for perception to happen, all these steps have to take place beforehand. Because if you didn't know how to respond to it, how to recognize this, you wouldn't be able to perceive this. It's like me asking you, I've got something in my hand, what is it? Why can you not perceive it? Because you can't recognize it. And let's just imagine you didn't know what this was. This is the first time you're seeing this. It's like, you know, if there's someone here who doesn't know what these leaves are called. Yeah. You could only go as far as saying it's a leaf. But you wouldn't be able to tell me any more about it. Perhaps you wouldn't be able to tell me what else might you do with it other than offering it to the Swaminarayan. But there'll be those in the audience who will say, this Swaminarayan is a betel leaf. We can chew on it. You can chew this. That's because you know things about it. But what if you didn't know things about it? So you see, to perceive this in its entirety, you need to understand not only, or you need to go through not only the perception part, but the remainder of it as well. All of this that happens at the beginning is essential for perception to happen. So much so that the Buddha says, without the rupa, without the vedana, without the sanya, without the sankhara, there is no beginning, end, or standing of perception. Perception cannot exist without these four things that have to happen as prerequisites for perception. Now, this might sound a little bit technical. I'm only sharing these technicalities or these technical details with you because soon enough you'll start asking me questions about some of these things. But I'm not going into too much technical detail because we can talk about this until the cows come home and there'll be more to talk about. Just on the subject of what Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara and Vijnana. But for the purpose of our conversation, I need you to understand what each of these things do, what function they perform. Because it's only when you understand the function they perform, do you begin to understand something mysterical that has been mysterical up until now. Let me drop that bombshell on you before we continue. That is, you don't need a self to understand the world. Right now, perhaps you feel, and I'm sure you do, you feel that it is you who have perceived, who has perceived that this is a pen. I can prove it to you with one simple question. Whose pen is this? Yes, you'll say, I don't know. But you do know something about it. It's not yours, is it? Yeah? You know one thing for certain. This pen is not your pen. Meaning, it's somebody else's pen. Meaning, you're already thinking about yourself. That is how you could say, it is not mine. Gotcha. Without you even knowing it, you can't help it. You're already thinking of me. As in not me, you're thinking about yourself. This self business is what we are making our way to address eventually. We're going to get there. Because freedom from self is the biggest freedom of all. The greatest freedom of all is freedom from self. That's why I asked you earlier, you know, we got our freedom in 1948, but were you actually free? Have you been free? You are not going to be free until the Buddha frees you. It is only the Buddhist philosophy that can free you because it is only Buddhist philosophy that talks about the mind and the citta that has to be freed. Right, let's come back again. Right now, you feel that you have a role in understanding what this is, what this object is. You have a role in understanding what this object is. I'll ask you another question just to prove the point. Who's listening to this sermon right now? Who is listening to this sermon right now? Don't be embarrassed. Come on. Who's listening to the sermon right now? Me. Can't you see? And who's doing the sermon right now? You, Swaminarayan. You are doing the sermon and then we are listening to the sermon. Isn't it obvious? Is that you? Do you even need to bother asking me that question? You'll say. Let's come back here. How do you hear things? ear, brain, auditory image, dropped on the mind, that becomes the rupa, that becomes the recognition, and then response, recognizing, responding, and perceiving. See, don't you see a process here? If this is the process that's running right now, what is the purpose of you being here? As in the self. Let me draw a parallel so you can see the difference. Thankfully, I have a couple of pens today with me. So I'm going to use this. Don't anyone get worried, okay? Just stay there. I'm going to drop this pen in a moment. So in fact, I'm going to let go of this pen. You know what's going to happen when I let go? What's going to happen? It's going to drop. It's going to fall. It's going to drop. Right? Fall. Before I do this, I'm going to ask you this question. Now, who's holding on to this right now? Swaminarayan says. Who is going to let go of this pen? Swaminarayan says. Once Swaminarayan lets go of the pen, what's going to happen to the pen? It's going to fall. Who's falling this pen? I'll ask the question again before I do the experiment. Okay? First of all, who's holding onto the pen? Swaminarayan says. Who's going to let go of the pen in a moment? Swaminarayan says. What's going to happen to the pen when Swaminarayan says, let's go? It's going to fall. Okay, I'll ask the next question as well. Who's going to catch the pen? The flow. Let's say that is also someone. Okay, the flow is going to catch the pen. Who's going to fall the pen? That's not even English. Who's falling the pen? You don't have an answer to that, right? Okay, well, as you've already passed the test, I don't need to drop the pen. Thank you. Why can't you answer the question, who's falling the pen? Why can't you answer that question? Are you not obedient to me? I'm asking you a question. Why can't you answer the question? Who's falling the pen? What is the answer? Nobody's falling the pen, you'll tell me. Nobody's falling the pen. Swaminarayan, you let go of the pen, fair enough. Yeah, you held on to the pen, yes. You let go of the pen, yes. But don't ask me who's falling the pen. That's gravity. That's gravity. So who's gravity? Who is gravity? That sounds an absurd question, does it not? What do you mean, who's gravity? Gravity is not a who. Why are you asking this really weird question, Swaminarayan? What's wrong with you? Who is gravity? Gravity is not a who. It's a process. It's a function. It's an energy. That's what it is. There's no who here. There's no person doing it. There's no entity doing it. It's just a process. It's a function. It's an energy. Really? What about this then? What about this then? Is this not a process? Is the mind not an energy? Is this not a function? Aramana vijana lakkanam chittam. The function of the mind is to receive, recognize, register, respond, and perceive objects. So why do you take the credit for it then? Why do you, who are you? You have a name, right? I don't know your name. So I'll just say you, and you tell yourself, yes, Swaminarayan is talking about me. And give yourself that me, the name, right? So let's say your name's John. I'm asking you, hey, John. Why do you take credit, John, for perception of a sound? If it's all a process, if it's a function, if it's an energy that's doing it, why do you take credit for it? Who turns the fan at your in your home? Who turns the fans? Who? Who? The current. Or what? The electricity board. The current turns the fans because there's an induction current that goes on in there. It's a physical process. Once you connect, once you give energy, there's a motor in there, and then the motor takes over, and then there's motion. You can't say, you can't ask the question, who turns the fan? Who lights the bulb? This bulb. Who's lighting it? No, I'm not asking the question, who switched it on? That's not the question I'm asking. That you will answer. You say the Anagarika Mahatmaya did that. But who's lighting it? Who's doing that? No one's lighting it. It's a process. And you can explain the process to me. That is what science does. That's why science is objective. And it's not subjective. Because in science, it matters not who does it. If a process is followed, if the steps are followed, if the causes are lined up in the right order, you get the same result time and time again. That is the scientific method. Now I ask you then, you hear this sound, don't you? Who's doing it? Who's hearing this? If hearing is a process, if hearing is the function of the mind, if hearing is an energy, then who's hearing it? Who? Now you begin to understand that this is an invalid question. I'm trying to give you something really profound here. And perhaps you're grasping maybe 1% of it, and that's perfectly fine. Because this is the first time I've spoken to you about this. But our conversations will build up on this in future. But I'm asking you, can you give an ownership to something like gravity? Who owns gravity? Who gets to call the shots with gravity? Who decides whether gravity, what gravity does, whether gravity pulls or gravity pushes? Who decides that? Is it a who that decides it? Or is it just energy and science? There's a process, there's a function, there's a method. Yeah, there are laws, there are principles, and that's how things work. What about this then? Another test before I do the pen drop test. Another test. I'm going to make a noise in just a moment, and I want you to do this. I want you not to hear it. All right? What? Come on, if you're taking the credit for hearing things, then take the credit for not hearing things as well. What? I dare you. You take the credit for hearing things, right? Because when I asked you who hears me, you say, I hear you, Swami Nas. I hear you, I hear you. I heard you. I heard you. I heard you. This is me, I'm John, and I hear you. It's John that's hearing you, you tell me. Right, John? Then don't hear the next thing I'm going to say. Okay, I'm going to make noise. And what is the task that you have to do? Not hear me. All right? Put your hand up if you didn't hear me. Why? I told you not to hear me. Can't you do just one thing I ask you to do? For everything I do for you. I come all the way from Ingiriya. What? It's been like, 20 weeks now I've been coming here. Or more or less. And I ask you to do one thing for me. I ask you, just don't hear me. Why are you so disobedient? Why could you not stop hearing me? Why couldn't you stop it? Because it's not you who's doing it. Why did you all hear me when I asked you not to hear me? Because it is not you hearing me. If it was you who was hearing me, then you get to decide when you hear and when you don't hear. Do you agree? So if it's not you who decides when to hear, what to hear, why to hear, who to hear, then, and still hearing happens, would you not admit then that hearing is a process and it's not you who's doing it? I'm building up an argument so that you can, in a way that you can all understand. Is hearing not a process where you have no role to play? Huh? That's why you couldn't stop yourselves from hearing the sound that I made. Because you have no part to play. Can you? I'm sure you've been in this situation. At least most of you will have. Someone's driving the car, you're in the passenger seat, right? And they're just talking to you, they're looking around, they're not paying attention to the road ahead of you, and you're in traffic, right? And without the driver's knowledge, the vehicle starts moving, you get closer to the vehicle in front of you, and now you see it, you as the passenger seat, but the driver doesn't. Who starts applying the brakes? You as a passenger, you've seen the vehicle ahead of you, but the driver hasn't yet. Who applies the brakes first? Huh? You do, right? But you're the passenger. You're the passenger. Why are you applying the brakes? You go standing on the chassis, don't you? Stop, 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 and your legs start moving and you start applying the brakes. Even before you've asked the driver to stop. It's almost automatic, especially if you are a driver yourself, right? You can't help it. You're trained to do it. Okay? My question is this. What good is there in you trying to apply brakes if you're in the passenger seat? What good is it? Absolutely none. Why so? Because it is not you who's driving the car. If you're not the one who's driving the car, then you don't get to decide when the car stops. Agreed? If you are not the one driving the car, you don't get to decide when the car stops. Right, now let's come to my point. If you are not the one who's hearing, then you don't get to decide when you don't hear or when you stop hearing. Now you see the connection? I'll prove the point to you again with another example. I'm going to say something and I don't want you to think about it. Okay? Swami answers, stop teasing us. I don't tease you, I love you. I'll tell you beforehand what not to think about, right? I'm going to say a word in a moment and I don't want you to think about it. I'll write it on the board for you. So I won't even say it out loud, okay? Look at the board for a second. Now don't think about this. Don't think about this. What are you not thinking about right now? Answer. What are you not thinking about right now? What? Sorry? See, I didn't even say the word. I only wrote it on the board. And you're the one who said it out loud, and I asked you not to think about it, and you're thinking about nothing else other than a monkey. You monkeys, come on. Why? Go back to the car. Why is it useless for you to try and apply the brakes to get the car to stop? Because it is not you who's driving the car. If you're not driving the car, you don't get to decide when to stop or when to move. If you're not the one who's thinking, you don't get to decide when to think and when not to think. Now do you see why you suffer? Do you decide when you suffer? to you. If you were the ones who decided when to suffer, what could you also be able to do? Decide when not to suffer. Then suffering would be a choice, wouldn't it? If you were the ones who got angry, then you'd get to decide when not to be angry. Do you get to decide that? When you feel anger, do you feel you're in control of your anger? Yes, you might say, you know, I can control my anger, meaning I can make sure that it doesn't, you know, doesn't boil over. It doesn't get out of hand. I can control myself. I can go out for a walk, right? Or just, you know, switch my attention to something else. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about anger at its roots. If I ask you, just as an experiment, for the remainder of the month, don't be angry. Just don't be angry. Oh, ignore me for a second. Let's imagine the Buddha came here. That you're all subservient to the Buddha, right? You all respect the Buddha, you all regard the Buddha very highly, right? You're devoted to the Buddha. So, you don't listen to me, fair enough, but you listen to the Buddha, right? So the Buddha comes and says, don't be angry. Pingvatuni, don't be angry. Okay? From here on, are you all not going to be angry? Are you? But the Buddha said so. Why can you not control when you're angry? Because it is not you who gets angry. Therefore, it's not you who stops being angry. So what point is it in you asking others today, why are you angry with me? Stop being angry. Don't you make that accusation on others? Why are you so angry? Stop being angry. You know, if they were able to stop being angry, they would without your invitation. I promise you. But the same applies back to you as well. It is not you who feels anger. Anger is felt. It's a passive process, not an active process. But type a passive sentence into Microsoft Word and it will give you a green line under it and say, we suggest you convert it to the active. Because in this world that we live in, ladies and gentlemen, there's a doer for everything. Yeah, there's a doer for everything. I do, you do, he does, she does, we do, it does, they do, we all do. The kings do, the emperors do, the ministers do. The mothers do, the fathers do, the brothers and sisters, they do. The citizens do, the children, they do, the adults, they do. The monkeys do, the donkeys do, we all do. In our interpretation of the world, we are almost incapable of understanding a passive world. In our world, there are actors. There are actors who do things, such as hearing. Hear me out. What are you asking the other person to do? Hear me. You're inviting them to engage in an active process. So much so, you know, we talk about passive listening and active listening. You know, there are training, management training courses on these things. Active listening and passive listening. So then there has to be active seeing and passive seeing. Active smelling and passive smelling. See, if smelling is an active process, why must you hold your breath when there's a foul smell? Why do you need to do that? You know, mentally, why don't you just resolve for the next 2 minutes, I'm not going to smell anything. Why can't you just make that a resolution? You know, mentally, why can't you just do that? For the next 2 minutes, I'm not going to taste anything. For the next 2 minutes, I'm not going to see anything. Why can't that just be a resolution? Why won't that work like that? Because it is not you who's seeing. When you're not the one who's doing things, you're not the one who gets to decide when not to do them or how to do them. So, I go back to 2 weeks ago, or actually 3 weeks ago, when I asked you the question, how do you know that you all have a mind? How do you know this? You gave me the answer, because we can think, Swami Nwansa. And I asked you, what do you mean by being able to think? And I heard from the audience, a few people said, Swaminas, we have free will. We can make choices. We can make choices. Now I come back to today's discussion and I ask you about what you said back then. If you are the one who makes choices, then make a choice not to hear what I'm going to say next. Make a choice. Out of free will, decide and determine and resolve that you won't hear me for the next couple of minutes. Can you? So who's the one who makes the free choices? Who's the one who makes the will? Who's the one who does? Let me bring it all in one line for you all. There are no doers. There is just the done. Simple. Yeah, simple to say, Swami, no answer, but I still feel I'm here doing something. Yes, I understand. This is easier said than done. But we've got to understand what our destination is, so we can start making our journey there. I repeat, there is no doer, just the done. When ignorance takes over, we begin to identify with the done and we perceive a doer doing it. That is what you perceive as self. You want me to say that again? Tomorrow, next week. No. There is only the done. See? It's only the done. I've proved to you that there is only the done. That is why you can't not hear me. You can't not hear me. If sound is there, if the vibrations of the air, if this medium carries the vibrations to your eardrums, and if they fluctuate, if they vibrate, an electrical impulse leaves your ear canals, you know, through your auditory nerve to your brain, and then the brain then goes and does this, drops an auditory image onto your mind, a chitta is born, and there is nothing you can do to stop it. Nothing. You're helpless. There's nothing you can do to stop it. Now, when I asked you to not hear me, I saw some of you in the audience going like that. See, if you have to do this to not hear me, then that's not you doing it, is it? This is the body. You're making physical changes to your body. I'm talking to your mind here. I'm talking to your mind here. I'm asking your mind to not hear me. Because you know that the mind is essential to hear. Because, you know, where does suffering arise? What is it we are trying to tame here? The body or the mind? The mind. You know that suffering arises in the mind. Yeah? Fear arises in the mind. Grief arises in the mind. Sorrow arises in the mind. When you hear things that you don't like to hear, you suffer. Yes? Someone swears at you, you hear things that you don't want to hear, you suffer. Someone shows you things that you don't like to see, you suffer. Now, those days I remember when we first started doing some of these talks, right, not here, at the monastery, we used to show people gruesome images and video clips of how people get tortured. And we do that sometimes in our meditation programs with disclaimers and in ensuring that, you know, people are able to tolerate it. But to a general audience, I would never do that. I would never do that to you. So don't you worry. I'm never going to come bring some video clips here and show you the real world. This is a make-believe world that you live in. In this world, everything's tickety-boo. No. You know, all you have to complain about is maybe someone bumping into you and not saying sorry. That is because you haven't seen how dark this world is. For that, you have to dive into the dark web. For most of you, you might not even know what I'm talking about. You go on the internet, right? That's only 10% of all of the information on the internet that you can ever access through your Google and your web browsers, 90% of the internet is actually not accessible to you, not using normal means and procedures. For that, you have to dive into the dark web. In the dark web, it's a whole new ballgame. There are no rules, there are no regulations, there are no law enforcement authorities. Anything and everything is acceptable. From drugs, to weapons, to torture, to rape, child abuse, anything. You name it, you can find it. Believe me, I'm a technologist. I've been there. I know what it's like. I've tried it all. No, not drugs, or the weapons, or child abuse. But I know it's out there. I've seen it. And with virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies, right? You can deal in these things at the drop of a hat. No one knows you, no one can track you. You're invisible and almost invincible. Almost invisible. So much goes on out there, ladies and gentlemen, that you don't even have a clue. I wish and pray that you don't have to, you are never exposed to such, what's the word? Hell on earth. I wish and pray that you are never exposed to that. Because I feel that most of you will not be able to bear it. Some people, they just take a dive into this dark web just to explore what this is like because they hear it on the grapevine. Someone tells them, maybe they see it on a forum somewhere, on Reddit or something, and then they go on just to see what this dark web is like. Some of them, they go on to commit suicide because they just can't bear how terrible the actual world is like. People take revenge in many ways that you can imagine. You know, on one of these sites, you can order a murder. No, you can. All you have to do is just give them the address and pay by bitcoins. Half up front, half after the job is done. And just to prove that they've done it, they'll post a video clip for you. What service? And you can actually ask for specifics. I want the ear cut off first. Yeah, you want me to stop, right? Exactly. I can't continue, I know. This would be too much for you. One day you'll be grateful for Swami Nuhase coming here and doing the sermons to you. Today you don't understand that, not fully anyway. You don't know what I'm trying to save you from. Just like we didn't know what our parents tried to save us from when we were younger. You have no idea, ladies and gentlemen, what the Mahasangha is trying to save you from. The suffering that you understand is just the suffering that you know. You know, just a bit of extra work at the workplace, you know, stressed at the workplace, depression, right? People ailing, people dying. That's what you know. I don't mean to take a condescending tone here, but most of the time, you know, that's what most people know. When you ask people why they suffer, they say, money problems. Huh? Why are you suffering? Because my father died. That's why I'm sad. That's why I'm really sad. That is all they know. All the evilness in the world, it exists because we are a civil society. A civilized society, you don't get to experience these things. You're not exposed to this. But young people of today, right, they know the technology better than you will ever. Your children understand this technology more than you will ever in your lifetime. When I say the word deep web, some of you, I'm sure, will have been there. But I'm sure it will not be the adults here. It will be the young folk. They're exposed to these things. And what you see time and time and time again becomes normal. That's how the mind normalizes. Right? When you see the same thing over and over and over again, it is normalized. How did they, when they first started showing nudity on television, how did it first start? Initially, it was all blurred up. Right? You couldn't even show anything above the knee. But now, normalized. It's not my job to say whether it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that is how normalization happens. The more you're exposed to it, the more normalized you become. Young children these days, they play violent games. And they often get the question, Swami knows, is it bad to do so? I ask you, is it bad to become normalized to violence? You answer. Don't ask me the question. Yes, it's a computer game. No one gets hurt except for the player. Yes, when you shoot, no one dies, but you've shot nonetheless. You've shot nonetheless. Internally, you're normalizing to it. Violence, you become normalized to. Drugs, normalized. Sex, normalized. And then, when you release that child into the world out there, without the guardianship, protection of the parents, now they're in a dog-eat-dog world. This is like training for the mafia. What a wonderful way to train young children these days. All you have to do is create a computer game where they are trained for violence. Legalized terrorism. Don't you think so? We all had something to say when we got to hear that child soldiers were trained in some armies. I don't want to hurt anyone, so I offend anyone, so I don't drop any names here. Right? Child soldiers were trained for terrorism. Right? People were really bothered about that. Because a child was given a weapon and asked to shoot. Yeah? And that was a big thing for everyone. There was a big hoo-ha around the world, and people who fought for child rights and people who cared about children went ahead and acted. They brought in new laws, they brought in new rules and regulations, child laws, child protection, child safety laws. The whole world reacted to that. But what about the terrorism training that's happening in your living room? In your child's bedroom. No one talks about that. No one says a word about it. And the parents turn a blind eye. Yes, no one's dying yet. But you're training them for violence. You're training them for theft. Grand theft. I won't say anymore. You're training them for things like, as you run along the road, if someone bumps into you, push them and carry on. If you're on the road, right, someone bumps into you, get out of the car, pull out your weapon and shoot them down and then carry on. This is training nonetheless, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you be fooled. This is training. Answer this question for me. Pilots, before they're let loose on an aircraft, where do they get their training? In a virtual cockpit. In a simulation. Yeah? They're trained in a simulation. So in the simulation, they are trained. Where are you training your children? In a simulation, right? These simulations are the video games. I keep telling you, one day you'll be grateful. Today you don't realize what Swami Nansi is trying to save you from. You think Swami Nansi is just coming and teaching us a little bit of how the mind works, how the chittas work. It's a bit technical, a little bit of a Buddhist philosophy. This is just scratching the surface. I have so much I want to share with you. And so much I want to save you from. I don't have enough time to give you all that. It's not a very nice world out there, I'm sorry to say. It's not a very nice world. All the bad deeds that you've done, ladies and gentlemen, will come back to haunt you. If you don't free yourselves from samsara, no one else is responsible for your well-being, for your happiness. If you've done the bad deeds, they will come back when the chickens come home to roost. No one else is going to be responsible for that. But understanding the Dhamma, you can go on to become a sotapanna. Once you understand the Dhamma, you can be freed from the four great hells once and for all. Next up, you have the human world to deal with and the heavenly abodes to deal with after that. If the human world is so bad, then need I say any more about the four great hells? That's why last week I told you, do yourselves a favor. And now that you've started this journey, keep on it. It was incredibly difficult to get yourselves on board this journey, on this train. You have no idea how much merits have helped you get here. Continue to engage in those meritorious deeds. Whatever deeds you've been doing, looking after your parents, you know, doing for them, these are all meritorious deeds. Serving the sasana, providing for the Mahasangha, not an individual monk, the Mahasangha. What about the monk who lives in your local temple? Do they not represent the Mahasangha? Yes. Am I somehow more virtuous than that monk? No. Who are you to make that call? That's why I say, don't make personal offerings. Make offerings to the Mahasangha. Because the Sangha, the Mahasangha, teaches us the path to deliverance. Because that is what they have committed their lives to. Delivering themselves and then along the way helping others do that. When we give, we get. So when you help pave the path so that the Mahasangha can continue their service of delivering themselves and others along the way, you get to jump on that bandwagon. You get to enjoy that journey. You get to get a free ride on that journey to your freedom, to your salvation. Sorry, that was a long detour. Coming back. I only wanted to tell you about the dark web and the things that go on there. I won't show you things like that. I certainly won't in one of these sermons. If you come to the monastery one day, perhaps, you know, if you come for a meditation program, right, in a controlled environment, having given you all the disclaimers and gotten you to sign the forms, perhaps, you know, I might show them to you. Just to show you how terrible it is out there. But my point was, if I were to show you something like that, that would not be a wonderful sight for you. It would not be a sight that you would like to see. But you can't help it. That's why mentally you will suffer. You might feel queemish. You might feel revolting. You might feel repulsive. You might feel these emotions. Sometimes you might even faint. That's because you don't have control on your thoughts. It is not you who thinks. Thoughts happen. The long and short of this is, I'm conscious of time as well. The long and short of this is, ladies and gentlemen, there is only the done. There is no doer. But just me saying this doesn't fix it for you. That's not enough. There is more that you need to understand. But the ultimate destination is where you come to the understanding that there is no doer, just the done. Right now, in this moment, when I ask you the question, who's listened to this sermon, you will wholeheartedly, with no doubt whatsoever, no skepticism whatsoever, you will say, Swaminathan, I am listening to the sermon because you feel it is you who's listening to this sermon. My question again is, why do you need a you to listen to the sermon? Why is a you needed to listen to a sermon? Why is an I needed to listen to a sermon? Why do you need a self to listen? Because listening is not something that someone does. Listening is a process. If something is a process, you don't need a self to do it. Agreed? If something is a process, you don't need a self to do it. So, who's holding the pen? Swami Nuanse. Who's going to let go of the pen? Swami Nuanse. Who's going to do the falling? Swami Nuanse. The pen? Is the pen going to do the falling? If the pen is the one that's doing the falling, the pen should be able to stop midair. So is it the pen that's falling? No. Is it an active process or a passive process? It's an entirely passive process. So if you say that the falling of the pen is a passive process, what about holding the pen? Is that an active process? Still you feel yes. That's because I haven't taken you all the way yet. You think, I'm holding the pen. Swami Nuanse is holding the pen. And he is going to let go of the pen. That's because you think there's a Swami Nuanse here doing the sermon, holding the pen. You feel that there's a being here. You feel that there's a self here, that there's a me here. There's an animal here. Not a beast, an animal. A sentient being. What's really here, ladies and gentlemen, is just a process. Here are a bunch of processes that work in perfect unison. They're perfectly orchestrated. One process after the other, after the other, after the other. These processes are so fantastically engineered. Don't ask me who engineered them now. Because in a world of cause and effect, there is no room for who. Many a time the Buddha was asked this question. Venerable Sir, Rupa, am I in the Rupa or is Rupa in me? Am I composed of Rupa or is the Rupa composed of me? Am I and Rupa one? 5 questions about Rupa. Am I in the Rupa? Is the Rupa in me? Am I composed of the Rupa or is the Rupa composed of me? Or rather, 4 questions. Those are the 4 questions people used to ask. Because, you know, you sensed an Atma. In some religions, in some faiths, in some beliefs, teachings, they talk about an Atma, right? Atma. It's spelled in different ways. Atma, Atman, and so on. A soul. Where does a soul come from? When you are dead, who is reborn? Is it you? Is it somebody else? In your previous birth, who was that? Was it me or was it somebody else? Because if it's somebody else, then why do I care about what deeds I do if it's somebody else who's going to do the suffering, right? Yeah? I mean, it's a valid point. Who cares what bad I do if the consequences come to somebody else that's going to be my next birth? It's not me, so why do I care? I have a question for those who believe in that. What about the suffering that comes to you now? Are you okay with that? Are you okay? Can you satisfy yourselves with the thought that, well, it wasn't me who did the deed, somebody else did the deed. What to do? I have to suffer for it. Are you happy with that? Are you okay to settle for that? Of course not. So whether it is you in the next birth or somebody else in the next birth, when you are in that birth, if you suffer, you have a problem. As you have a problem right now because you suffer. So I think the question is not whether I'm going to be reborn or not and whether it's me or somebody else. If suffering comes, then there's a problem. That's why I always focus these conversations on the now. Right here, right now. Right here, right now, ladies and gentlemen, if you're suffering, that is the problem we have to deal with. Worry not about what's going to happen next. Because you're still unsure about whether it's going to be me or somebody else. Answers to those questions will come. Soon enough, through these talks. But for the time being, if you suffer right now, let's agree that there is a problem. Let's agree there's a problem. But they talk about an Atma. And then they ask, what about the Vedana? Sir, Venerable Sir, is the Vedana in me or am I in the Vedana? Is the Vedana composed of me or do I compose the Vedana? 4 questions about Vedana. They had the same 4 questions about Sanya, the same 4 questions about Sankara, and the same 4 questions about Vijnana. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times 4, 20. Visadivida sakkaya ditti. 20 types of sakkaya ditti. In your readings, you may have discovered that sakkaya ditti is self-view. Rupa is the self. Is the self in the rupa? Is the rupa in the self? Is the self composed of the rupa or the rupa composed of the self? Is the self in the vedana or the vedana in the self? Is the vedana composed of self or is the self composed of vedana? Sanya, sankara, vinyana and so on. Visadavida sakkaya ditti. These are the cankers. When you come to right view, and someday it will happen for all of you, when you come to right view, this is one of the views that you will break free from. When you come to sammāditti, your journey in the Buddha Sasana starts there. That's where it starts. Your journey in the Buddha Sasana starts where you have realized the answer to that problem. Because this is one of the nivarana. There are the 5 nivaranas. Nivarana, because it closes the path to Nibbana. That is why it's called nivarana. It is a hindrance to Nibbana. You cannot proceed to Nibbana. You cannot proceed on the noble path. For as long as you have these questions about, is the rupa in the self? Or is the self in the rupa? Now you might say, Swami knows, I've never had these questions, only until you told me now. Now I'm starting to have these doubts. I never even began to think whether I'm in the rupa or the rupa in the me. I'm disappointed that you even talked to me about it, because now I have these problems. No. I'm just defining the problem you've always had. You've always had this problem. I'm just giving it definition so you can understand the size of it. You can understand the shape of it. You can understand what it looks like. See, you don't need to have had the question of whether I am in the rupa or is the rupa in me. But you still had the I, didn't you? I was always there. You were always there. I asked you the question, who's listening to the sermon? And you all said, me. Who's seeing me right now? Me. Who's going to have the sandwich later? Me. Who's going to offer the Swami Nohan's alms? Me. All of us. Me and my family. See, isn't that rupa? What is the perception of the world after all? If you distill it down to the 5 things, rupa, sabda, gandha, rasa, sparsha. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Right? What about listening to a sermon? What's going on right now? Sight, sound, touch, smell, and taste. This is how you perceive the world right now. And I ask you the question, who's seeing this? Me. Who's hearing this? Me. Who's feeling the touch on your chair? Me. See? I've just given it definition. You've always had that problem. So don't be fooled that until today I didn't have this problem, but now I'm walking home with a bunch of problems. Before I got here, I didn't have sakkaya ditti. Now I'm full of it. I came here as a sotapanna, but now I'm leaving as a pruthakjana. You just bring yourselves here. I'll do my job. Your job is to bring yourselves here. And one more thing. Do as many merits as you possibly can. All of this is energy working in or against your favor. This is energy. Right? Merit is the universal currency. Money can't buy you this sermon. Trust me. Not all the money in the world will bring me here. It's not money that brings me here. How much did you pay for a ticket to be here? You know, the other day, this is the last thing I'll say and I'll conclude for today. Yesterday, at the monastery, we were going for alms. So, we had the English sermon in the morning, and then after that, I was going for alms, along with the rest of our monks. And this thought occurred to me. Because all of you came to my mind for a quick moment. And as well as the people who were in the English sermon in the morning. Because we had discussed something quite profound, and we were talking about how to apply the Dhamma into practical problems in life, and how we have to take a different approach to problem solving, anicca, in the application of problem solving. That is what we were talking about. So I was thinking to myself, you know, if you had to bring up a child, your own child, okay? If you had to bring up your own child, feed them, teach them, educate them, teach them about the ways of the world, right? And strengthen them and prepare them so that one day they would look after you, be there for you, give you the best that they can offer, shelter you, be kind to you, be by your side, and see you through well in this birth and as you take your leave in the birth after this. If you had to do that for your own child, how much labor, toil, sweat, tears might you have to expend? How much might you have to expend? Well, you know the answer because that is what you're doing right now. Right? To bring up your child. I know you do it for out of love for your own children, but there's partly an expectation that my children will one day look after me, will at least be there by my side, right? To at least to hold my hand. And if I'm weak and I'm frail and I'm unable to fend for myself, you know, my children will be there for me. And that they will see me well. They will see me through well, right? And they will be there to guard me. And of course, you know, in my last days, at least be by my side, you know, bring a monk, maybe perhaps, or chant some pirith, or maybe once I'm gone, you know, into the next world, I maybe at least do a pirikara offering or give an alms and transfer merits to me. To do all that, you have to spend a lot. You have to shed blood, sweat and tears. A lot. And then the thought occurred to me, what about the Mahasangha? What about the service that the Mahasangha gives you? Teaching you about yourself, helping you work out your mental stresses, your mental strains, your mental ailments, and helping you come out of it. Helping you resolve life's practical problems through the Dhamma so that every solution that you take is only a step in the right direction, not a step in the wrong direction. And eventually, helping you become independent so that you don't have to even rely on your children one day to do merits and transfer merits to you when you are dead. But how much do you have to spend on their behalf? I was going on alms, so I thought to myself, only an alms bowl full of rice. That's all. It's a bloody good investment, isn't it? All you have to do is offer the Swami Nuhanse a spoonful of something. Maybe every 2 years, a piece of cloth so that he can wear on his over his shoulders to keep himself warm and keep himself cool when it's hot out there. Just a roof over his head so that he doesn't get wet in the rain or heats up in the sun. And if he's not feeling too well, maybe some medicines. You don't have to send him to school. You don't have to buy him toys. You don't have to get a Netflix subscription. You don't have to even get him an internet connection. You don't have to give him games and you don't have to give him a phone. He doesn't need any of those things. You don't have to teach him. You don't have to do any of those things. But in return, what do they give you? What do they give you? They give you the path to freedom, the Noble Eightfold Path. In my humble opinion, that is the best investment anyone can make. I was only thinking about this because just earlier in the day I'd spoken with my mother and father. And they've planned to go back again to the UK, but before they go, they're going to come and see me tomorrow. And I was going to talk to them and explain to them, you know, when you brought me up and when I was younger, Amma and Appachi, you know, you must have had hopes for me. You must have had dreams about me, about how, because my father always wanted me to become a doctor, as all Asian parents do. Right? So that's what they wanted me to do, become a doctor, look after them, you know, be there for them, and, you know, be the pride of the family. That's what they wanted for me. I understand why, as a father, he would want that. I was going to ask him tomorrow when I see him, Appachi, you know, to get that out of me, you had to spend a lot. But today, I give you the truth. I give you the truth, the path to freedom, once and for all. So that you don't have to suffer like you do again. If you get the Dhamma, if you grasp the Dhamma, if you understand the Dhamma, you can be freed once and for all forever. All you have to do is put some rice into my alms bowl. That's it. It's one of the best investments anyone could ever make. That is why the Sambuddha Sasana is unlike any other. You get much, much more than you put into it. I talked about this on this subject a few weeks ago in one of our English sermons at the monastery. I'll explain to you in more detail one day in the future why making an offering to the Sambuddha Sasana pays back rewards in multiples. There's a reason for that. It's a very logical reason. And I'm not just saying this because I'm a monk today. I myself am making offerings to the Sambuddha Sasana, don't you see? My life has been offered to the Sambuddha Sasana, ladies and gentlemen. I have offered my life. Of course, you make offerings in ways that you can. You do the best you can. You go as far as you can. I have offered my life. Of course, I had dreams, goals, plans. If I were a layperson by now, I'd be a very rich man. But I offered myself to the Sasana. Because I understand that in the Sasana, if you put in a little, you get a whole lot back. Do you see what I've gotten back today? Peace of mind. The things that sometimes bother you and trouble you and worry you, bother me, trouble me, and worry me no more. So, we need to understand this truth. And I'll help you. Just bring yourselves here. That's all you got to do. Just bring yourselves here and engage in as much merits as you possibly can. Start at home. Charity starts at home. Your parents are a bountiful of merits. Do make sure you use them before they're gone. Once they're gone, that's it. You know, the alms that you give and transfer the merits to your parents after they're dead are not as meritorious as you do when they're alive. It's different. Once they're dead, they're no longer your parents. You can make offerings to the Mahasangha and transfer merits to them. Offering to the Mahasangha is meritorious, yes. Offering to your dead parents is meritorious, yes, but they're no longer your parents. Shall I prove it to you? If you were to kill your mother, it's a heinous sin. But your mother's dead, now she's born as another woman. Kill her, that's not a heinous sin. Because she's no longer your mother. She's only your mother in this birth. So while she's with you, do whatever you can. Do everything you can. To your mother, to your father. Treat them like gods. Because they are. They are the gods that brought you here. They would have had some influence for you to be here today. Some influence. Maybe they kicked you out one day. And that's why you got here. Always bear that in mind. No matter how old they are. If they're still alive. If their heart still beats, be there with them. Do whatever you can. Bring them here if you possibly can. If you can't bring them here, take what you take from here, get from here to them. Explain to them in your own words. Perhaps they might not be prepared to listen to the Swami Nuanse. Because sometimes they might be a little bit stubborn. Perhaps they are, you know, too long in the tooth to actually come and set aside their beliefs, their preconceptions, and start to actually take something new. But they'll listen to you. Start by talking to them how good they have been to you. Then they'll become more receptive. Don't become the teacher first. First become their daughter, become their son. Help them be at ease and then start gradually, slowly helping them. You remember the Buddha's words. feeding your parents for 100 years and looking after them is hardly meritorious at all when compared to giving them the Dhamma and freeing them from samsara. For 100 years, if you feed them, look after them, take care of them, give them shelter, right? 100 years, that is barely anything at all when compared to giving them the Dhamma, the truth. Because if you do that, you free them for good. If you treat them now, you treat them for this life. What assurance do you have that in their next birth, you're going to be there to look after them? It's going to be somebody else's business, and they won't treat them the same. They may not have the same compassion and kindness that you do towards them. So the only thing you can do now is look after them now and give them the Dhamma. So do that. Engage in as many meritable deeds as you possibly can and bring yourselves here. Because here is where you reap what you sow. Your sowing you do when you do your meritable deeds. Come here and we'll reap what we sow. All right, time's up. We'll continue our conversation next week. Ah, I forgot to drop the pen. All right, let's take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have all acquired to all those who are deserving of it. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us take a moment to transfer this merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nvanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery and provide for the four requisites, food, shelter, arms and medicines for the monks, as well as those who continue to extend their know-how and their well wishes. May by the power of these merits, they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers, our employees, our teachers, and those who have grown to great lengths to help us, support us, and assist us in any way, shape, or form possible and available to them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take this moment to transfer these merits to the Devas, Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to fulfill and protect the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And by the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones who have passed away in our name, our ancestors, our forefathers, those who have predeceased us, because it is in their fruits, in their sweat, labor, and tears, and blood. Today we enjoy the converse that we do. Let us be grateful to them and take a moment to transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who might have lost their lives in natural disasters, such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, fires, pandemics, and so on, reminding ourselves, and amongst them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this infinitely long journey of samsara, and those who will have gone to great lengths to provide for us, to protect us, and to take care of us. May they all rejoice in all the merits we have acquired throughout the day. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become an arahatan vahanse, or an arahataranin vahanse, in this very life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you now. Raga kinnang midatnva Dvesha kinnang midatnva Moha kinnang midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapa labeva Nivan sapa labeva Nivan sapa labeva Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belin Sila loka sila satyoma Nibbana paramasukhen sukhita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.